Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We've had the honor of having on the show with us Judy Pickens, a wife and mother who has been wrongfully convicted of the death of her four-year-old son decades ago. Judy speaks of the injustice done to her and how it has affected her family throughout the years. Judy's husband, Carl, has also been on the show to talk about his overwhelming experience as a husband who one day went to work, having a family, and eventually losing his family to this wrongful conviction. So we have on with us this morning Judy Pickens. Judy, are you on with us? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Judy, are you on with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Yes, we spoke yesterday. We've had Judy on for a few episodes, and Judy's experiences with this whole ordeal has been, it has strengthened her family. At the same time, it has left them with so many questions as to why this has happened. Judy is currently serving a, what is it, Judy, a life or two life sentences?
Yes.
And this is what is so unfair as well, is she's serving two life sentences for the death of her four-year-old son, whereas her daughter and she have an excellent relationship. They are still in contact with one another, and Judy still sees her daughter, who was 5 years old at the age at the time of this offense that they alleged to have happened. So, Judy, you want to speak a little bit about that, and then we can go on to further questions.
Yes. Again, I say good morning to your listening audience. Leona gave me a good segue into this. Absolutely. We, as a family, have totally been victimized and wrongfully done. My son, Michael Pickens, and my daughter, Kimara Pickens, were both ill at the same time, as children would be. And the long and short of it is we went through the necessary steps, took them to the doctor, took them to the ER, did all the steps that they asked us to do, left them with family members, et cetera. Over a course of a week and a half to two, they never got better and eventually were hospitalized just to be ensured that they would not get severely dehydrated while we're not keeping anything down. We were led to believe it was the stomach flu, then it was viral, it was a bacteria infection. They gave us so many different things that it wasn't even funny. But in the course of things, my son, Michael, our son never got any better. And as a result, he expired in that he died and passed on. During the course of their hospitalization, they would get better and then not get better. And moving forward, we have been in this perpetual circle of grief. It has, you know, grief has stages, as we all know. And in the five stages, you come across each one of those gamuts of emotions. But we have never been respected enough to be allowed to even at first accept it. Because if you can believe it or not, I still live in this place of it can't really be true. And then go through the necessary steps as a family and heal over time. Nothing can ever replace what we lost, but there is a healing that I do believe comes to all who suffer such a loss. It's a loss that doesn't match anything else. It can't be a competition. Well, me losing my mother or losing a friend is the same. No, it isn't, because we as women and mothers, nurturers, we carry these lives inside of us. We become connected, almost symbiotic, in such a way that nothing can describe it. It doesn't take away from dad, doesn't take away from grandparents, but that's a connection, that's a bind that never severs. And even beyond the grave, you still feel it. And it may seem strange to others, but any mother can sympathize and empathize with me, because you feel it. When your children are wayward or they're not quite in good standing with you, your relationship is strained, you feel it. When they push away, you feel it. When they're being drawn away in other ways and other things that will happen as they grow and live. And so it's no different, only it's 10 times worse, because at some point, hopefully, you get reconnected. As to our daughter, Kimata, she is thriving, successful, happy, has been asked, questioned, interrogated, and the answer has always been the same. Nothing has ever happened. Home life was great. Mom and dad was good. Grandma was good because, you know, they look at everybody in the family, of course, but really not much. They really focused around mom and maternal grandmother and my husband and so forth. And so they asked all the questions that I guess eventually you would ask, and the answers always kept coming back the same. All was well in school, you know, because they do check all of that to see, well, was the child coming to school in a way that would suggest that the authorities needed to be concerned and intervene. And again, the answer came back, no. Family was very much involved. They were present when the child had milestones like plays and et cetera. So there was never any calls, any red flags. At the daycare that they went to, they visited there just to make certain, after they decided to look into things 2 years later, to make certain that all was well there, that there were no red flags, and of course there wasn't. And so they talked to family and friends, and again, they came back with this same resounding answer, nothing. So for a while, things went dead and dormant. But in the process of things going dead and dormant, we were thriving and living and doing the very best that we could. Kimata would go on to grow as a young woman should, and thank God she did. And I thank God something like this could turn a child in a direction that you could lose them, really lose them. But I thank God that she didn't get caught up in drugs or alcohol. She's never been arrested, thank God. She has thrived and excelled in school in every level that she grew, and now is in college excelling at that in her chosen profession, and will be starting an internship, and she's done 3+ years now in college, so she's getting to the point of getting ready to graduate. And it's just something that a mother and a father wants to see. My husband is, you know, of course not incarcerated, but, you know, I want to be present when my daughter walks across the stage. I missed her walking across the stage in middle school. I missed her walking across the stage in high school. I do not want to miss her walking across the stage when she graduates from college. So that is the full circle, but I don't want to be remiss. I have an older child. We have an older child. His name is Joseph Armstrong, and he's 26 years old. And he was in the home as well. And so this didn't just affect Kimata and Michael. This also affected Joseph because, being the oldest, these were his siblings. And to be snatched away from his brother and his sister, to be, lose mom, I can't even begin to tell you. My son Joseph also comes up here regularly and brings our granddaughter Chloe up here as well. And so we have an outstanding and resounding bond as well. And his question to me continuously is, Mom, I don't understand this. He said, you've always raised us in church, and how is it that I used to get angry? And that brought tears to my eyes. My son told me how he used to get angry and how we would always be out there helping people in the community and always at church. He thought we lived at church because we were at church so much. And he said, how could you do all these things for God and God let this happen to you? It's a difficult question to answer. Because is there really an answer? So I went the biblical way, as we would all do, in trying to help them understand that things happen, life happens, even unjust things happen. As hard as that was to say to him, I said, but son, we can't lose faith. And he did for a while. It was difficult for him to still embrace the things of God. You know, so he kind of started following in the Rastafarian beliefs and things. But then he came on back, you know. But he still feels, I can feel it. I don't know how to say it without, there are no words. But you can feel the difficulty he still has with that. So I know that there is some pain there with the system. He's angry with the criminal justice system. He's angry with the politics of it all. And he just wants his family whole. You know, he wants his family back together. And even when this is done and God does what he promised, which he showed me my release, when he when I become fully exonerated and the charges dropped and I am released, we all still won't be coming home, you know. And so there will always be that missing piece. But I can't that is the whole of it all, is that this, and that's kind of, I'm grateful she took us this way, because that's kind of where I was going to come from today, that this incarceration has been, today has been a very difficult morning, because, you know, and you, when you go back through all of this, having to relive it all, it's very difficult, it's very painful. And then having to go back into the environment that you go back into, you can't really express like you need to. And then and feeling safe, because that's been the biggest thing for me here of late, is feeling safe in the space I'm in to be able to release and be as fully transparent as I possibly can and still protect my heart and my mind. And when I think of my children and I think of my husband and my mother and all the countless people that I have relationships with that we are forever connected to, and the absenteeism of not being there in the manner in which I desire and the way they need me to be, it's very difficult, you know. I'm a wife and a mother, a pastor, a prophet, a teacher, a mentor, a model citizen as most as anyone could be, paid my taxes, voted regularly, stood in the gap for people, took strangers into our homes, give until we couldn't even pay our own bills, literally. Just was always there. If a person ever needed us, we were there. When I say taking other people, taking them and their children, sometimes the parents would drop the kids off and never come back. I mean, just the way it was. That's how my grandmother, Evelyn Hollins, raised us. She raised us to help. Don't talk about the problem. Be a part of the solution. And that's how we were. Maybe too much, but that's how we were. And so we're at a place now where we want to heal and be whole. We want to be back reunited, and not just for ourselves, but for so many others. So I just thank God, because I was blessed to have three children that whom I love very dearly. And they have weathered the storm. You know, we all have some battle scars. We all have some wounds. We all have some pain that will may never really go away, but we can look at it differently and we can process through it and maybe end the pain, help someone else get through their pain. So I'm hoping that that brought us up to where we are now. I was thinking about where would we go today, because we've kind of touched so many different things. And what hit home for me was the public defender's office. You know, even when you have money to get an attorney, you almost need an endless pot of money. I mean, because attorneys they know the law, they know the language of the law, and if they're a good attorney and they have a good rating on their law board, they understand how to navigate through all the nuances of the law. But they also, it is a business, and so they do require outrageous fees. And most people that find themselves in the position that anyone has been in trouble with the law or incarcerated on any capacity, come to find out that they never are prepared to deal with the attorneys. Now, I don't say that in a negative manner. I just mean that they'll start off telling you that this one fee is sufficient, and or they'll make you the promise, oh, that I can handle this. We've dealt with these cases before. It's not that big of a deal. We just go in there and handle things, and it'll be okay. And then when you get there, and the ball begins to roll, however slow the beginning is, you discover that often they are learning what they told you they already knew, or in fact they never knew anything about cases like this. And this case is so specific, you do have to have some kind of background in it. And so as a result, I started off with a paid attorney, Rosenberg Bloom, and his firm, and they were well-known and had a high success rate. You all might remember him from being in the news, from being one of the ones who helped to and worked with former Governor Greitens and that situation that was happening. But before that, he worked on countless cases. Many of the ladies in his prison also acquired him because he was so well-known that, you know, but he also came with a well-known fee. And we paid the $25,000 that they asked for. Church, family, and friends brought that money together to do so. And not quite a year in, his partners said, hey, we want more money for whatever that was. Now, he gave us a flat fee on a contract that we signed, still have a copy of it, gave us and told us this was our fee to have him. There was no agreement, no term that you would pay us another $5 every so often, another $10, none of that. It would snowball into something else, and they wanted these outrageous amounts of money that we honestly, truthfully did not have. I would spend a year going back and forth in the courtroom, defending myself, representing myself, as to why I felt like I should retain that firm as my attorneys. Eventually, the judges would side with the attorneys, with Rosenblum and their firm, and relieve them of their duties where I am concerned, and only allow them to, they were supposed to pay us back the monies that we paid or show us how they spent it. And we were able to get back, I believe it was like $5,000, and maybe not even all of that. And so there was no way we could then hire another attorney. So then I was forced to go into public defender's office and receive a care by way of the state.
Can you hold on a minute, Judy?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they wanted $15,000 within less than 30 days.
Judy's been speaking now.
Yeah, they wanted his firm wanted $15,000 in less than 30 days for investigation fees, he said. And when we originally came on, he knew we really didn't have a lot of money because he wanted like $17,000 just to start, and we had to raise the rest of that remaining $25,000. Our bishop and family members came up with that money for real.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how he originally went on and took the case. And he was referred to us by the lawyer that assisted us with getting my mother to get custodianship of Kimata to get her out of that system. And
you know, this is really a problem with lawyers. What's the lawyer's name again? Because I'm going to at some point in time have a show just on lawyers who have let their clients down or who have scammed them in some way or another. And I have a couple already that I have mentioned previously. So if you can just let people know so that they don't make the same mistake in getting involved with these type of lawyers.
They won't have to worry about him. His name is Tucci. He's actually doing traffic law now.
Well, John Tucci would come along later. Scott Rosenblum is the one who we paid the $25,000 to in his firm. And they were the ones who then Scott made an agreement that his partner said that he did not clear with them. So there was a breakdown in communication within their firm. That should not have been our responsibility, though. The moment that contract was signed on their company letterhead with their senior or one of the senior partners' signature, who became – I didn't even know that he was my attorney until I went to my Raymond, and I saw him in his courtroom speaking for me, and he said to me, "You don't speak to no one but me. I now represent you. Your family and church and community has raised the money." That's how I would come to know that. And he made it abundantly clear that I would only speak to him and anyone that represents his office and no one else, not by way of phone, correspondence, or anything else. If they don't come from his office and they have not made me aware that they were coming, then I am to not be in communication. So this man, he represented me. He made himself become aware to me that that is who he was. And so you can imagine that I was taken back when I get a letter that tells me that they we have not given him, from his partners, mind you. This came from the partners. So I was getting correspondence from both, from Scott Rosenblum and then from the partners that was saying that Scott didn't have the authority or, in so many words, to make this agreement without getting all of their signatures. That is their understanding. Again, a breakdown in communication that has nothing to do with me. I have a contract. I have a signed contract, not one, but I had multiple signed statements from them, legal documents, binding that should have been binding in the court of law, but ended up not being binding over the course of a year. And so as a result, I had to then petition the courts for proper representation. And this is where John Tucci would come in at, but he wouldn't come in even initially. They gave me a public defender who the judge first said he wasn't going to give me one because I paid for a lawyer. So I would spend
six months. Right, he told us that because we had a paid lawyer, we did not qualify to get a public defender.
Yeah, because basically what he was he was saying I wasn't indigent. And to get public assistance, you had to be indigent. And there's no way I could justify being indigent if I was able to acquire an attorney. That wasn't his problem.
And with that $25,000. And this was the same judge who sat with, and I can't remember his name.
His name is Garvey.
Who sat with that sat with Rosenblum, because the day that we were to go to court to see if they were going, when Scott Rosenblum wanted to resolve our case, I went there like 30 minutes early. So I'm sitting out there waiting on it to start, and lo and behold, here comes the judge and Rosenblum from out the judge's chamber before we even began.
It was already an agreement.
They come out laughing and talking, and then when they saw me sitting out there, they froze and all went separate ways.
Yeah, and that's how it happens in most litigations. There is an understanding in the chamber. There is an understanding over drinks. There is an understanding at some brunch or lunch or country club or wherever they hang out at. They have an understanding, and then they come in and put on a show. So then now we're at the theater, and we're watching what is happening before us like it's new and fresh, and everybody plays their part very well. But these are the people that we put ourselves in because we had no other choice. And when the judge, I would not rest. How the public defenders even became a part of my life, and John Tucci is, I argue my case to the bitter end. And I began to, something inside of me rose up. I didn't even know it was there. And it rose up. Anger, hurt, just dissatisfaction in the system and in this firm that is a renowned business that should know better, being a lawyer. And the judge said, now, I tell you what, if I didn't know any better, I would think you were a lawyer. And I didn't say anything because I didn't know I could say anything. And he said, well, I tell you what, let me think about it. So before they were getting ready to take me back to the workhouse, there was two females and another lady sitting with so it was really three females sitting there, who I would come to later find out were part of the public defender's office. And the lady stood up and said, her name was Cassandra, I can't remember her last name, and she said to me, she said, now, Cassandra Williams, thank you, Lord. And she said to me, she said, I tell you what, she said, the way you represented yourself in this courtroom today and argued your case and got the judge to even consider it lets me know that we're going to find you somebody. I went back to the workhouse. It would be the next 30 days or so. It wasn't even that. It was maybe months. It was a few months. The judge then called me back and said he pondered and wrestled over it. He couldn't come to no resolve. He wanted to relieve the firm because they do require more money, and he understands how it could be a hardship for my family and myself. And so as a compromise, he would be willing to render me indigent, so that I could then file the necessary paperwork with the public defender's office to acquire legal representation. He had no other recourse because at the end of the day, he was in error and so was Rosenblum. Now, he gave me a data boy or a data girl or a little push in the right direction by freeing me up to be able to do that. And so the firm, then the public defender's office, had already contacted me and said, well, we're going to get you an attorney, because after what they heard, they knew that it was ridiculous. And they then got me someone that they thought, they said, was really great, and he's really good, and he was dogmatic about the law, and this is where John Tucci would come into play. And John Tucci came, and he did give me the impression, I mean, he came to see me regularly. He brought his investigator Mary with him regularly. They went and talked to different people and said, Judy, your story has never changed. We see that everything that you said, when we walk it back, we follow it through. They did the due diligence that I could see based off of what they said verbally out their mouths. And so, and I believe in his investigator, Mary. I still to this day believe in her. I, however, don't have any no regard for Mr. John Tucci, because at my evidentiary hearing, that man came out with Shirley Rogers and her team of people. They all came out of the judge's chamber. They were all friends. and he was now on their side. And not only was he on their side, he basically said that he didn't represent me because he didn't think that he could. He shouldn't have to, that he did his job. His job was not to defend me. It was the state's job to convict me. And that the burden of proof was on the state, and therefore he didn't have to do a thing. And thank God for Melanie Harvey, who challenged every last one of them. If you would want to speak of an attorney who I felt who did her job, and I believe exhausted, she went through the paperwork, she pulled out all the biases, she pulled out all the liars, she highlighted the expert witnesses that the state brought forth who were actually went to old court transcripts and discovered where they had perjured themselves and countless other cases, how they have been known to be expert witnesses who lie, who bend the truth, found out how they pressured people and made them uncomfortable, made other people feel like if they didn't do this, if they had situations that were before the courts, how things could not fare well. All that stuff came out in the evidentiary hearing.
We're going at some point in time, we are going to have a show. We're going to be asking people who have been affected by their legal representation, or those who were denied legal representation, or those who have been scammed. We're going to have a separate show on that where people are going to be calling in, and we are going to invite people on to talk about that. And because there has been so many, Judy and Carl, that have gone through what you're going through, even with attorneys, and they talk about children in schools being bullied, and they talk about cliques in the schools with students. We have adult cliques, and we have adult bullying, and unfortunately, a lot of these lawyers who they are in cliques with their own peers will either judge someone that's asking for their legal representation because of someone, another lawyer that might have some kind of bias or his own or her own theory or whatever it might be, which has affected a lot of prisoners or anyone from getting the help that they need in the legal representation area. So what you're talking about right now, we're going to have a separate show on that, and you will be back on that show to be talking about that as well.
Thank you, because I think that is – I'm so glad that you are doing that. I'm glad that this is opening up other avenues of communication, because I hear that story continuously. Now, what's so crazy, Leona and Carl, is that I did not know until just the last couple of weeks ago that my roommate, Ellen Boehm, who's been here for 28 or 29 years, had the exact same prosecutor, Shirley Rogers. She is in here for a choice she did not do. But she gave up. Now, I can never give up. With my dying breath, I can never give up. But she gave up. And it could be that she just got broken down and worn down. We worked together at NVE. But anyway, the fact that she had the same situation, the same scenario, blew my mind. And then I would discover that there was another lady in here with the same situation, with the same public prosecuting attorney. And I thought, now, wait a minute, there's a pattern here. There is a pattern. And then it made me even more angry, because this has been allowed to go on. I won't even stop there. I look at these judges who are either burnt out, not all of them, but they're burnt out, biased, prejudice, they come with baggage because they're people. They come with baggage because they're people. And they're supposed to be able to separate their bias and hear the case as it is weighed and weigh it against the law. That I understand the scales of justice are in balance, but he should be the pendulum in between the scales, and he should be the one that helps to tilt it when it needs to be tilted in the right direction. I should never, nor anyone in my position, or any person for that matter, in this United States of America, should ever feel like when they walk into a courtroom, they will not receive justice. They should never be in fear of being ostracized and railroaded. That is a real reality. I think about all the paperwork that has been filed, how my paperwork, I thought it was just happenstance. I wouldn't get any of my court transcripts back. I wouldn't get the paperwork that I had timelines to be put into, would never make it there. And I began to write the court clerks asking, hey, what's going on with this? I filed my appeal. Why haven't I gotten this paperwork? I filed this. Why haven't I gotten that paperwork? I cannot tell you how many times we never got it. We never received it, only to discover that they had been sending my paperwork everywhere else but to me. The good thing about the Department of Corrections is when you have legal mail, you must come in and sign a ledger for it, then open it up in front of your caseworker and shake it just to make sure that no one's sending you anything you shouldn't have. So there is a track record that shows I never received this paperwork. There's also a track record that shows that it went to men in men prisons, and they had all of my detailed court work, transcripts, and anything else that was a part of that legal document sent to them that inhibited and delayed and thwarted my ability to fight for my defense and possibly even be released by now, because the timelines I had to at least pursue my my justice was delayed, denied, and hindered, even to the point of stopped, because they gave it to individuals who it didn't belong to. It wasn't in their name. The mere fact that the caseworker allowed, I don't know how it is in the men's prison, I can only assume it's the same way as the women, but for us, we have to come in. They come from the United States Postal Office, and you have to then, they show it to you, you open it up in front of them, they don't take their eyes off of you, you shake your paperwork, they hold it up and glance, perusely glance, and not reading it directly, and then they give it back to you, and you go on about your business. You sign for that. So I can only assume that that's not just something for the women. It should be done in the men, and therefore, when that casework or whomever gives them their legal mail, they should have realized this is a female. Because it said Judy Pickens.
That's right.
And why
the mail
did Joe Blow...
Sometimes the mail doesn't get beyond, once it gets to the mail room, it doesn't get beyond the mail room. So it could also be that, because, as you said, it's happening in the male prisons. You know, this is why I started this radio show, because I'm hearing from you exactly what I've been hearing from prisoners for a long time. And as far as the lawyers go, I started it because I personally experienced these lawyers that did exactly to you what they did, and it not only to me, but to all others. And this is the reason why this show was started, because of all these things you're talking about, Judy. It's not isolated, and it should be brought to the awareness of the public. And judges take a vow when they become judges. They take a vow to be honest, to serve their constituents as well, but they don't. This goes all the way back to biblical times when judges were put in place to be fair. Look at Solomon. I mean, if people think about the judges back in biblical times compared to the judges today that are so corrupt, it's pathetic. It's pathetic.
Yes.
And this is why we see the mass incarceration in this country, because the prisoners have no outlet. They don't have decent lawyers. They don't have the money a lot of times to pay, and the outrageous prices. Then they have to deal with the prison guard unions. A lot of lawyers are afraid to go up against the unions.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have politicians that are afraid to go against their own peers that don't have the guts to do the work that they should be doing. There's so much against prisoners these days, against the people of the country. And this is the sad thing about it. And this is why shows like this have to be initiated, established, and the word has to get out to the people. But the people have to do something, too. They have to come together in unity, and they have to fight all of these things. Because if we don't fight it, it's going to get much worse. And it's going to be in everyone's backyard, not just certain people, not just people of color, not just the low or middle-class whites. It's going to be in everybody's backyard. So these are things that we need to look at, too.
I totally agree with that. I think my husband, being an African-American man himself, can also rein in on this, because I look at the neo-genocide of our people, and more specifically our African-American men, and it is meant to break down the family structure. And so I've allowed myself the opportunity to sit in that space to see and feel what my husband was going through, being an African-American man, doing what a man should do, and that being present in a home, being the model for his daughter to know what a man should be, being the model for what his sons would know a man should be, being a husband that his wife could love and depend on and trust and live and lean on. And so being the godly priest in our home, and then having to, you go to work, you pay your taxes, you're not breaking the law, you do what you best you can to try to help some. You know you can't help everybody. And so then to see that, and then working in the system, he being a substance abuse counselor, working for drug court, I don't know, Cole, if you went into any of that, but working with judges and working with people, having clients who are also in the situation where they have been incarcerated and came out, and he having to represent them and as far as their addiction. Cole, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did that the other day. It was in reference to, but you know, that was the biggest issue for me, because when all of this happened, and I think because of my background is one of the main reasons why I was never implicated or connected to Judy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I stated when we first began talking, when you read this situation, you would think this is a single parent mother. You wouldn't think this was something that happened to a two-parent household, because they totally, totally kept me up out of it. Totally kept me up out of it. Originally, they questioned me because I was told that they were told that I was a addict. I was, when in actuality I was a recovering addict, and I was a substance abuse counselor for back then what was called drug court. When we first got it here, I was the first counselor they had for drug court. That's how I became familiar with, a lot familiar with the judicial system, because I'm in the courtroom every day, and I'm sitting across the table from judges, attorneys. I'm going to conferences to D.C. with them, et cetera. So when all of this started happening, even though I knew all these people in the judicial system, all of them became distant.
Mm-hmm.
They became very distant.
Mm-hmm.
The only time, because I'll never forget the first time we went to a hearing for Kimata down at the juvenile court. This was not too long after Michael had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting in the lobby waiting to go back, and it just so happened they were having a drug court conference there. A lot of the judges and attorneys I worked with were coming through the door, and they noticed me sitting over there. So they came over and spoke to me and gave me condolences, et cetera, et cetera. And so, come lo and behold, I find out that the caseworker for Kimata's case, she was down there, and she went back up into the office, you know, bewildered on why all of these attorneys and judges going over speaking to me. And that's when she found out the relationship I had with the court system at that time, because I also had done some things for the juvenile court. So she's talking to a young lady saying, I don't know, something's real funny. I don't know what's going on with this family down here with this child. And she asked the young lady, you know, the young lady asked her what was her name, what was the name of the person. And she gave her my name. And she said, well, you don't know Carl, because he comes in here and do two or three groups a month with us with the kids. So by the time we get to the courtroom, my name is not in and on or mentioned in any aspect.
No. Deliberately. Intentionally.
I just became invisible from that point.
Mm-hmm. And so the crazy part of it,
they want to portray the victim, I mean the person that's on the in the trial, they want to portray that person as a low class criminal, or they want to put something into it to make the jury look at that person in a very very negative way.
Yes.
Again, you know, Carl mentions, and I know there's a lot he probably doesn't say because of the type of work he does. But there's a lot of people that work for the government that have loved ones inside, and there's a lot of people from homes where you're going to find someone in their family, or friend, or a distant relative, or whatever, that's in prison, and you're going to find that they also have a relative that's working for the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the sad thing, because there are so many good families that have loved ones or someone they know in prison, but at the same time, they themselves or their loved ones or someone that they know works in a very influential position. And in cases like this, it's very difficult to, you know, for a jury to go against the prisoner or a defendant if they see this kind of a background they're coming from, because most of the time these people are coming from decent backgrounds. So what they will do, the prosecutor, law enforcement, or whatever, will portray this person or family members or whatever, they will portray them in the worst way, because they want not only the jury to look at them as being low class, you know, very possible criminals, but they want people in the public, out in the communities, to look at them the same way. You know, in the beginning, there was when it happened in my situation, they were saying two good families were affected. You know, they were saying the person that did the offense was known as a very pleasant, very well-mannered, very good young man who had no prior history with the law, who was never involved with drugs or alcohol, was a four-year college student, lifted weights, did all these things, had a prominent job working on the weekends and school vacations and all this. Went from all of that to now trying to get a lawyer for this young man and not being able to because these lawyers have a clique.
Yes, they do.
And one of the lawyers was affiliated or friends with the person that was affected by the offense.
Mm. Isn't that something? And so instead of making that abundantly clear in the forefront, you're going in thinking, and that's how we do. That's how people in situations like this, you don't know all the connections because they do have that good old boy, good old girls club. And in the midst of all of the corruption, you do have the Lone Rangers. You do have those people that we know in corporate America, we call them whistleblowers, people who will go against the grain, who will say, no, I'm not good with this. But those people get so tired of peddling upstream that they come out of the field altogether and go into other areas that they're degrees and their experiences can be utilized. And that's a tragedy because it was those voices that every now and then you would see justice done for someone. It would take people who, you're finding the people that are helping people today more so than anyone else are the law students. They're hungry, they crave the knowledge, they're fresh, they have new eyes, they're not burnt out, they're not coming in with biases, they're just coming with a blank slate, and they're trying to make a name for themselves and win their dean and their professors over. So they are coming into a gung-ho, like they're zapped up on something, but that's a good thing because with the fresh eyes and with the not being biased, they can then offer and lend a point of view and find information that's been staring us directly in the face the entire time, but has been overlooked. I'm mindful and reminded of the JonBenet Ramsey case, where we saw that unfold. I was at home. We saw that unfold on national TV. We saw this prolific couple who was well known, who had political ties, who had a lot of money, and who had a name and a status in the community, and not to mention that they were Caucasian. Their lives play out in front of us. We watched them bring this child out of a basement where she had been raped and killed. We watched all of this play out, and it would be years later. They never even considered the family. And then when they did consider the family, those people did not spend a minute, a second, an hour anywhere. They had high-profile attorneys who stepped in. They had friends who had friends that stepped in, and they're living their lives. Every now and then we'll see a documentary on them or where are they now. But I know where they're not. They're not incarcerated. I know where they're not. They're not trying to rebuild themselves. They are living their lives however they are. I'm not saying they didn't come out of this thing unscathed, and I am not trying to say that they had it easy, but I just am mindful that if ever there was things painted for you, and at that time, my opinion was, oh, well, they had to have something to do with it. I mean, you know, this was before this thing happened to me, so I have a different opinion, but I also believe that it never got to this point. When I tell you that comes to my mind on a regular basis, it does, because I think about how we've been fighting nonstop to clear our names and to get this taken care of. I think about all the police officers who have just somewhere along the way lost themselves, and how they even know. They know that the detectives and the officers know that the attorneys are lying. They know that the prosecutors are lying. They know this, and they willingly and agreeingly go into it with them. They make these unspoken agreements where you're going to need me in the future like I need you now. I mean, I've read people's court paperwork where the prosecutor threatened witnesses and threatened to take women who were otherwise not in the best situation. They've used dope fiends and drug addicts, and I don't mean no disrespect to anyone who has a substance abuse problem, but they use people who had a definitely they didn't have a good reputation. They were known to be abusing drugs, out there on the streets, living any kind of way, doing petty crime to support their habit. They brought these individuals into some of these individual cases as key witnesses. Gave them a shower, gave them a haircut, put clothes on their back, and put them before a jury that's supposed to be of our peers, which that's not their peers, and represent them because that's gave them a few dollars, told them that they wouldn't let them go to jail. I've heard the stories. I've read it. Then when you contact the people later, the story is the same, just a different face and a different name. Well, they told me I could lose my kids if I didn't say this and I didn't say that. Literally put the words in these witnesses' mouths, professional and otherwise. Tell them to say it like this. They rehearse their interviews, their testimonies. They rehearse them over and over again. They script them even. This in the court of law in 2020 is happening. I can't even fathom how it's allowed, how it is being allowed to be in our society today. We're not living in some third world country where you could go out back and be shot. We're not living somewhere where people don't even know what the nearest post office is. We're living in a society where we're on the cutting edge of technology. We're on the cutting edge of everything. And even at the time when we're in a society where our president can – our chief commander can get online and tweet about anything and it'd be socially acceptable, but when a person is fighting for their lives, they've been denied. I do not even understand how we can do what we do and say that we are the land of the free, the home of the brave. I can't even begin to understand how we have fought for liberty for all the other illegal aliens and people who have left their countries because of political abuse and sought political asylum here, and how we support them. And I am not against by no means. I think anybody that needs help should come. I'm just saying that we put so much effort into everything else that we deny people who are here already. We have people who are hungry, who are in desperate need right here, and they can't even go to their local whatever and get the help that they need. They have to jump through hoops. We have people who are diabetic and who are disabled and can't even get the disability insurance that's allotted for them because they have to go through all these hoops and hire the lawyer they can't pay and give them 33% of whatever they do win just to be able to get $700 or $800 a month, which can't take care of anybody in the world I live in, substantially and satisfactorily, to survive. And yet here we are, myself namely, my family namely, fighting for our right to be, to exist, to have our right back to have the American dream than anyone that is, basically to have a home, to have our family, to continue to work, continue to pay our taxes, to continue to support our community, to continue to support our neighbors and our neighbors' children, to be a presence. Do you know when I got arrested and I went to the workhouse, they isolated me, threw me into an area by myself, and I didn't understand it because everybody else had somebody in the room with them. And this was their words to me. They said, you're a high-profile case. People out here picketing. We have bishops and pastors and preachers from all over. You're everywhere. And so they were scared that somebody was going to try to bomb, storm the, if you will, the doors and try to take me out. I thought to myself, I'm not Michael Jackson. I'm not O.J. Simpson. You couldn't make me believe the stories that the correctional officers would say. They would come across the cell, the room that I was housed in, and they put the world up, and they put all this other stuff up, and they would taunt and tease me and abuse me. And I'm telling you, I have lived with things that I have not even shared with my family. The hardship and the abuse that has come my way and trying to fight my name. And then one day, I'll never forget it, one of them came across and they said, you know what, we know who you are now. I saw you on TV, and you were preaching, and he said, I didn't realize you were that person, and things calmed down. So at that moment, God took me out of obscurity and brought me into the light. And for that moment, I then had peace. But in the beginning, it was torture. I was tortured from the women. I was tortured from the people that were put there to protect and keep peace. Custody, care, that's what their job is. And I was put in a situation where, honest to God, I was afraid to go to sleep at night because I didn't know what was going to happen to me. You know, I woke up so many times with people standing over me, and I had to go into prayer, and I couldn't understand it. I lay in TCU here at the prison dying. I'll never forget that, on oxygen, and I had and the nurses thought that they thought that I was so far gone that I couldn't hear them. And I heard them say, clear as day, we're just waiting on her to die. I don't think she's going to make it through the night. But I heard them. And something about what they said made me say, absolutely not. I will not die. And something inside of me began to fight. And when the morning time came, they said, we didn't think you would make it. I didn't even have the words in to tell her, but I would tell her years later that I heard her. And she should be careful when standing over a patient what she let comes out of her mouth. It's just that God put a fight in me. And he said, Judy, this is not your end. And so I knew this. And I began to minister and to preach a word to him and prophesy and tell him what thus says the Lord. And as God began to open it up, he told me, he said, Judy, when you open your mouth, I'll speak through you. And as I began to speak what God began to say to me, then doors began to open and people began to, you know, mercy came in and grace came in. And then he made me connected with all the different ones along the way. So, you know, I thank God. I am by no means nothing special about me. I'm a wretch undone, saved by grace. My family and I, we're not looking for people to go, oh, wow, these are some outstanding people. We're the average human beings who work for a living, who struggle like anybody else, who love one another. And all we want is to be put back together. All we want is to have our name cleared. All we want is the wrong to be righted so that we can begin to live our life beyond this, because there is life beyond the gate. And I'm going to get there. And not just me, but others. And if we don't, as a society, get tired of seeing what we see, then there is something wrong. I asked the question the other day in front of the ladies when I was teaching a Bible study here. I said, tell me, what do you see when you see what you see? And they were like, what do you mean? I said, when you look at something, tell me what you see when you see what you see. Now, if I look at a man who has a tendency to kind of go, hey, girl, am I seeing a man or am I seeing something else? And that's how you need to ask that question, because when we walk outside this gate and we are free and our names are clear, people are going to look at us because they're going to think they know what they know or what they perceive they know. And they're going to form an opinion. But you've got to be able to live beyond that opinion. You've got to, and I won't spend the rest of my life. At first I said I have to carry papers around saying I've been exonerated, I've been cleared. I've heard stories of ladies that got cleared or they were released and they've gone out there and still they're struggling with their identity, because even though their names have been cleared or they've gotten free, maybe they did the crime and they've done the time, they're still fighting against the prejudice that does happen when it comes to the disenfranchised. You have that issue. You have people who are struggling to survive out there in this world because our society is not forgiving. Our society is extremely judgmental. And so now we have people who are fighting just to survive in the world that we call America. And I know, I don't know what that will be for me, but I thank God for the support that I have in my community, in the church, among my peers. As my husband said, the papers tried to make it seem like I was this single mom. I remember hearing stories that people said they heard that I never worked, couldn't keep a job. I have never not worked. I've been working since I was 8 years old, and I have always worked in corporate America, and I've always worked in upper management. I've either been a chief financial officer, a senior manager over risk management. I've been an underwriter. I have always worked. It is never not, and I've always worked high-profile jobs that pay good money, that came with great benefits and perks and that took care of our family. It's never been an issue. I've never been afraid to work. Even in here, I work multiple jobs. I've never not worked. Even sick, I would drag an oxygen machine up the hill with an officer who escorted me all the way up, and I was a chapel worker. I ran the sound system so that the churches and the people that came in here could hear. They could speak through a speaker, and people could hear them. I put on all kinds of things. I've worked in the thespian section. I've never not worked. I've worked in laundry. Right now, I'm doing the books for the Missouri Enterprise Vocational Training System, where they make all the clothes, the furniture, and the things. When you walk in the courtroom and you see the benches and stuff, MVE makes that. When you see the uniforms that officers wear, MVE makes that. The uniforms that prisoners wear, MVE makes that. And I handle their books. I make sure that the books balance between here and Jeff City. And let me just tell you, the books balance, because I'm honest and I'm fair about that thing, and I don't cheat the people, and I don't hide stuff, and I don't fix books. The bottom line is they would never put a person in that position if they couldn't do the job.
And that's why we have mass incarceration, because the government does not want to give up that. The penal system does not want to give up the fact that they have prisoners doing all the work. And they're making money off prisoners and their families and friends of prisoners, because everything you buy today has to go through the prison system. It has to go through Secure, and it has to go through Globaltel, and it has to go through a lot of these others, Tech Secure. So this is why, I mean, the prisoners, you're doing an excellent job. The thing is, you get credit on the inside, but you don't get credit on the outside, because no one knows until you tell them, which you're telling them today, but no one knows all the good that a lot of prisoners are doing while incarcerated.
All the men have all the really good paying jobs. I mean, at the top pay scale in here, I make 71 cents an hour, and I'm at the highest pay scale. You know, essentially, I the position I hold is that a department manager or a factory, like, in a sense, assistant to the factory manager. And so, but I will only get the maximum they will ever pay you is 71 cents. The pay starts at 15 cents, and you work up to that. And so they're the same work that I do for them, I could do what I did at Aramore Corporation, and we're talking 70, 80,000 to start. And that was back then, so it's probably even more now, and with benefits. And if you meet your year quota, you get bonuses, you know. And they pay for me to travel to and fro to other locations to help train their managers and so forth. So these are the things that, you know, I didn't come in here backwards. I didn't come in here uneducated, uninformed. I came in here, and after I got over the shock and awe, I utilized the skills that were already in me, and I put them to use where I was and where I am. And therefore, I can't help but to continue to do that. It's making me want more. I want to be able to be effective. I want to be able to be a person that can help other women in a situation, not just women, but men as well. And so I am, you know, beginning to do some things or formulate some things in my mind and in my spirit that might be beneficial towards others. I've already started writing a book. In fact, it's book two. I have a plan to put together other programs that I think will help. These are the things I'm already planning for not being here, life outside of here. I'm already planning for that. And so I just believe and know, because God does not lie. Numbers 23:19 says, God is not man that he should lie, nor is he the son of man that he should have to repent. If he said it, he'll make good on it. And if he spoke it, it should come to pass. And then I'm mindful of Isaiah 55:11. God's word will never return back to him void. God made me a promise. God told me, Judy, I'm going to clear your name. You're going to be fully exonerated. He said there's going to be a sudden move. And the radio station came up. There was a sudden move. God told me that he was beginning to show me these things, and I see it. This is not here, so this came from the master directly, and so I receive and I believe that, and since I know he cannot lie, I know it's going to come to pass. And so I just thank God, because he's able to keep us, and like I said, I had a pretty rough morning, and I don't know how the day will fare, because you will have people that as they hear that you're doing things like what I'm doing right now and working towards getting myself out of here with the help of God, you know, there's two ways they'll fall. They will be supportive, and support you and do everything they can to assist and aid you, or they will become combative, angry, and hostile, and they'll lash out at you, and they'll make life very difficult. I've had them happen both ways since I've come on the radio station. Will that deter me? Absolutely not. I already began to pray and prepare myself for the backlash both ways. I've already solicited my family's support, and they are praying, and the bishop and so many others are praying with me in agreement as they are praying for you, Leona, and your listening audience. We just know that whenever God is about to do something, the enemy gets busy. And so I'm just thankful, and I'm grateful that you had us on here again today, that you've given us the opportunity to speak about the atrocities that have happened to us and to so many others. And then also thankful that there will be other shows that come from hearing these stories, because they need to be had. The people, there is never one story that will ever cover it all. There's not enough time that could ever really communicate effectively and efficiently all of the wrong that's been done to our family and to so many others. But it's a starting place. This is a great place to have it. It's kind of almost like a town hall meeting of sorts. This is a good place to begin to have that dialogue so that people can now be informed, hopefully convicted enough to do something, to get up and do something. Get past that's a shame conversation and move into activate yourself. Become an agent of one and say, I'm ready to go forward.
I want to thank you, Judy, for being on the show with us. I want to thank you, Kyle, for coming on. And, again, you will be invited on again within the next month. And I want to thank you so much, because you have brought so much light into the problems that we are having in this country with the mass incarceration, the type of people that are incarcerated, and it lets the audience know that there are good people and that prisoners should not be stereotyped. Lawyers should not be going along with their peers. They should be really doing what they're about to do. Judges should be more honest about what they're doing instead of going with the prosecutors. There's so many things that need to be repaired, and it certainly does not start with the prisoners. So I thank you for being on with us, Carl.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Judy. I really appreciate it, and I hope to see you, talk to you real soon. And I am trying to set up a radio show, too, so hopefully we'll be able to have you speak in directly in that way.
All right.
Thank you once again. We are leaving now, and Judy, we will be in touch
with you.
Thank you so much for both of you being on and shedding light. Thank you.
Okay, bye.